to a podcast about history made for middle school and high school social studies students and everyone in between. In this series, we will be discussing all the topics you would cover in an American history course. I am joined by Brendan Horoho and Nick Rishkevitz. Today, we'll be discussing the early European settlements in North America. So, Brendan, please tell us about mercantilism and why Europeans wanted to explore and settle the New World.
So the English were like everybody else in Europe. Their major concern was to become rich. The English started to look for the Northwest Passage. They started to look for ways to get to Asia. They started to do all these things to try to make money. They had a system that was called mercantilism. And so essentially what this is a system where you want to maximize your exports and you want to minimize your imports. And that way you're making a profit. And it creates a real trade imbalance. So what's happening is, like, if you look at modern day China, they produce tons of goods and they export them all around the world. Your iPhone, right? Maybe your jacket was made there. Maybe your computer was made there. And they don't import nearly as much. And so overall, year after year after year, the countries are making a profit. England was in the same sort of business. They were looking for ways to sell things to the rest of the world and become super wealthy. So they realized that the Americas were a perfect spot to grow crops, to search for gold, to basically create like a factory that would help make England wealthier. So they started to grow tropical crops. One of the crops that they became super wealthy from was tobacco. Tobacco, the natives had been smoking it for a long time, but in the Chesapeake Bay area and the Mid-Atlantic area, the Europeans and the English in particular were able to plant these Spanish tobacco seeds. They became super productive and they started to grow like crazy. So now the English could sell cigarettes back in Europe to other countries, and cigarettes are addictive because of the nicotine. So the English were now making tons and tons of money. They were also mining for gold, they were mining for silver, they were attacking other countries and trying to raid their ships. You had all sorts of different ways that the English and these other countries were trying to make money.
Thank you, Brendan. Nick, could you tell us about the first English colony at Roanoke?
All right, so let's talk about the first English colony here. Let's talk about what happened with that. So Sir Walter Raleigh, he was an Englishman. He had money. He had connections. He was able to get permission from the English crown to go and start a colony in the Americas. So he attempted to establish a colony that would be known as the Roanoke Colony. And again, remember, he did not go himself. He sent basically an expedition to go and do this. So they would actually land off the coast of North Carolina on the Outer Banks, and they would attempt to establish a colony there that would become known as Roanoke, and that would be in 1585. It's also interesting because this colony is known as the Missing Colony. It's kind of a mystery that's still around today that we're not entirely certain what happened. The colony was established, and after a period of time, they needed more supplies from England. So they sent a ship back to go to England to get those supplies, but there was a problem. Okay, off the coast of England, one of England's big enemies, a country we talked about in our last unit a lot, Spain, was preparing an attack with their Spanish Armada, their very powerful navy. So when this boat that was coming back to England to get supplies to bring to Roanoke arrives, it was actually forced and pressed into service to defend England from this Spanish Armada, this big navy that the Spanish had. There's a huge battle, and the Spanish Armada ends up being defeated, part of it due to weather, where this like big wind blew and blew them into the rocks and sank a lot of their ships and destroyed much of their navy. But the delay that was caused by that led to the ship from Roanoke taking over 2 years to return. And when they returned, there was no sign of the settlers. There was no sign that they had been killed, or there was no sign that they had died. The settlement was empty, and the only sign that they found was the word Croatoan carved onto a tree. There were a couple theories behind that. One theory was that the settlement was wiped out by the natives, or the Spanish, who had still had ships going up and down the American coast. Another is that settlers left to join native tribes in the area in order to survive the difficult conditions, or that settlers moved further inland and contact was lost. So that's the story behind the Roanoke colony, which becomes also known as the Missing Colony.
Now, changing gears here, Brendan, could you tell us about the first successful English colony at Jamestown?
So in 1607, the Virginia Company of London, they were given these rights, which were called head rights or land grants, which was basically to spark immigration. So in 1607, they come over and they're looking for the same thing that a bunch of explorers are. You know, they're looking for money, basically. They're doing this to either find gold or to grow crops, to somehow become wealthy. So when they come over, they immediately have a little bit of conflict with the natives, but they start to set up their colony, which is called Jamestown, named after King James. Go figure. Not only is Jamestown named after King James, but they place it on the James River in Virginia. And so Jamestown is as British as it gets, and it's this little tiny fort. They don't really do a great job with setting it up. There's a real focus on getting rich, finding silver or gold or something like that. And so these men that came over, these settlers, they were sort of wealthy. They weren't, you know, really hard workers. And so there's this just huge problem. They show up and nobody wants to work. So nobody is planting food. Nobody is doing manual labor. Nobody's putting up walls. No one's building, you know, like sturdy homes. They're just sort of, they're not in it for the long haul. And because they didn't want to do this manual labor, they start to have huge, huge problems down the line. And eventually you'd have to be saved. And so there was a man named John Smith who eventually shows up, and he is able to fix Jamestown. He's able to save it. It's near collapse. It's falling apart, and he's able to save it, and he establishes law and order. He has strict punishments, and he requires all colonists to dig wells, to work on farms, basically to earn their keep before they were allowed to go search for gold. You can't search for gold if you're dead. He established trade with the Powhatan tribe, but eventually was forced to leave after an unfortunate incident with gunpowder, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and that's not good for Jamestown, because when he leaves, they lose their strong leadership that they had. He had provided sort of order and structure like Brendan talked about. But once that kind of goes out the door with John Smith returning to England, things kind of return back to the way they were. You see kind of poor leadership. The people in Jamestown, again, kind of revert back to going and searching for wealth. They have a poor crop yield, and it leads to desperation and starvation amongst the colonists. And this becomes a time in the Jamestown colony known as the Starving Time. So it was over the course of basically the fall and winter months, and I believe it was, I want to say, 1609, where there was a very low amount of food available, and kind of the relationship with the Powhatan tribe had declined after John Smith had returned to England, and there was no way to kind of reach out to trade with them for food. So the settlers in this Jamestown colony face this long winter period where they can't grow any new crops with very little food, and it leads to them turning to extreme desperation. After eating all their food, they would kill their horses. They would kill the dogs and cats in Jamestown to eat them. They would end up killing rats and mice to eat those. There are stories of them taking their shoes, which were made of leather, and boiling them and eating them. And then there's also reports of cannibalism in Jamestown. At least one incident of a man attempting to kill and eat his pregnant wife, for which he was punished by being burned alive at the stake. So really, really tough time for Jamestown. It's a time where the colony nearly fails. You can kind of see it go the way of the Roanoke colony, where they could lose their entire population. The end result is they emerge from this winter in the spring with about 80% of the Jamestown population being killed due to starvation or the conditions at that time. So a very, very difficult point for Jamestown in a period where the colony looked like it may not survive.
So how was Jamestown able to turn it around and end up being successful?
Yeah, they were actually really lucky. So John Rolfe was a settler there at Jamestown who was able to trade for some Spanish tobacco seeds. And what was really kind of crazy about that was Spain had these safeguards in place to prevent other colonies and other countries from getting their hands on their tobacco, which they had been growing sort of in the Caribbean. And so this was a really, really dangerous thing to do. It was actually punishable by death. But Rolfe, somehow, no one knows how, is able to get his hands on these Spanish tobacco seeds. And when he plants them in the fertile ground that's in the Chesapeake Bay area, it grows like wildfire. And soon, every garden in Jamestown is growing tobacco. They are just making money left and right growing tobacco, and it's extremely popular in all of Europe, England included, and it's just making tons and tons of money for the British crown. So now you have Jamestown, which went from a small struggling outpost to suddenly a thriving colony.
Brendan, please explain the differences between the New England, Middle, and Southern colonies.
So the colonies are all really different. In the north, you have New England. It's cold, it's not great for farming, it's not exactly ideal for a place that you would want to land. When the first colonists really came over and settled in New England, it was the Puritans on the... When the first colonists came over in 1620 on the Mayflower, the Pilgrims arrived, and they arrived in Plymouth, which is modern-day Massachusetts. The problem was they were intending to arrive in Virginia, but they had just missed. So they survived bitterly cold winters and had to deal with all kinds of problems because they were much further north than they were expecting. They did, however, have lots of religious tolerance. You had Puritans up there. You had guys like John Winthrop, who was a Puritan leader in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. You had Roger Williams, who was a Puritan minister, who eventually separated and helped found Rhode Island because he believed strongly in the separation of church and state. The North was a little weird. So the Puritans and the Pilgrims, they did have these religious sort of beliefs that were kind of crazy. A lot of them believed in witchcraft and those kinds of things. So in 1692 in Salem, Massachusetts, you saw girls pretending to be possessed by, you know, each other or the devil or something like that. And 175 people were arrested and 20 were actually executed during this really famous witch hunt. Eventually, as the Enlightenment era rolls in, people sort of get over that. The middle colonies were really sort of like the breadbasket of America. They produced grain, cattle, fish, lumber, rum, iron. So it was like New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware. They were very, very productive, and they were doing, you know, great things for the economy. They were set up mostly by the English and the Dutch. The English had huge chunks of land, but the Dutch had set up New Netherlands, which was this little tiny area in what is now New York City. They called this place New Amsterdam, and it was basically a little colony that they had created on the island of like Manhattan, and they were setting themselves up there pretty much just for trade. Eventually, in 1664, the English realized that it doesn't make sense to have control in Pennsylvania and then control in New York and have this little tiny piece of New York City that they don't control, and so they go and they take it over, and they rename New Amsterdam New York City. So you have this sort of situation going on. One guy that's really interesting when we talk about the middle colonies is William Penn. He belonged to a Protestant group that was known as the Quakers, and he believed that he had a personal connection with God, and you didn't need church services. So he treated everybody as an equal. He didn't bow to lords or ladies, and the English sort of hated this guy because he went against the grain and against society. He was strongly in favor of pacifism, and Philadelphia, as a result, became known as the City of Brotherly Love. People from all over start moving to Philadelphia into Pennsylvania. So you had the Irish, the English, the Welsh, the Dutch, the Germans, they all come to Pennsylvania because of this idea of equality. What's really interesting too is that Penn, despite being, you know, the founder of Pennsylvania, also created Delaware from three counties that he owned, and he gave Swedish people there the right to self-govern. So there was a really large population of Swedes in Delaware. Now, the southern colonies are probably the most important, historically speaking, because they have really warm climates. They can grow almost all year long, and they make tons and tons of money for the Americans by selling things. Near South Carolina, they can grow rice and indigo really, really well. In Virginia and North Carolina and Georgia and South Carolina, tobacco grows really, really well. And so now you have that, and you have cotton, and these cash crops essentially start making tons and tons of money for the British, and people are becoming really, really wealthy. So originally, they start getting indentured servants, which are people who are kind of like prisoners, to come over and work in the fields. They work for a set number of years, and then they're eventually free to go. People realize that that's not a good way to make money, and so what they do is they start taking African slaves and bringing them over. So the first slaves were brought over at Jamestown, like we talked about. But eventually, 4 million slaves would be living in the United States in 1860 when the Civil War finally starts. So it really becomes a huge, huge business. And slavery, this unpaid labor, is sort of the backbone of the economy in the South. So the final case that I want to talk about with the colonies is Georgia. Georgia was created by a guy named James Oglethorpe, who was a refuge, and he wanted to create a refuge or a safe place for debtors to restart their lives. And he wanted it to be for Protestants only, you know, free of alcohol, no rum, no slavery, anything like that. And for a while, he has this running. But eventually, in 1751, the British take it over and they make it their own colony and they impose their own laws. So the colonies are really, really different, but you can see how they have sort of similar beliefs.
All right, last up, Nick. What kind of government was put in place in the colonies?
You've got all these people going to the New World, and it's kind of, you know, maybe a little uncertain as to how these colonies are going to be governed, how they're going to be set up and stuff like that. So we'll talk a little bit about the government now and kind of some of the decisions that were made and why these decisions were made. So first off, one of the things that's important to know is that with Jamestown, once Jamestown started to sort of establish itself and started to prove that it was going to be able to stick around, in order to get people to continue moving to the colony and to draw them there, they not only had the headright system, which I believe Brendan mentioned earlier, where colonists were granted land when they arrived, but they also did a few other things. One thing they did was they extended the same legal rights that people had in England to the colonies. So if you were leaving England, you knew that the rights that you had as an Englishman were coming with you. And that included certain things that had been established, a level of freedom of speech to a degree, you know, the right to have a fair trial and stuff like that. We also get the House of Burgesses, which comes about in 1619 in Jamestown, or eventually the Virginia colony. And what that was the first sort of democratic experiment in the Americas, we could call it. And what it involved was a legislature where in one part of the legislature, or the lawmakers for the colony, they were allowed to elect officials. So if you were a man who owned land in the colony, you were allowed to vote to have a representative for you. So it's our first kind of example of a representative democracy. And it was very limited. Not everybody was allowed to participate. Basically, it was only white men who owned land and had wealth. But the thing to note is that it's the first time where anybody's really being allowed to have this say, to have this vote. So that's happening down in Jamestown. We also see the Mayflower Compact that happens up in New England. Some of the pilgrims that were coming over on a boat called the Mayflower, before they arrived and before they disembarked and got off onto the shore and started setting up their colony, they drew up a compact or something like kind of a contract or rules for their society. And that's an example of self-government. Basically, they understood that when they got off the boat, they couldn't let total chaos take over. They needed to have rules that everybody was going to agree to follow and play by. And that's what they established through the Mayflower Compact. We also see the Maryland Religious Toleration Act. So in Maryland, a new colony would be formed. And what was interesting about that is it was a colony formed primarily for Catholics who were not accepted in England at the time. And This colony was designed to be a place where they could go to practice Catholicism freely. But what's also interesting with the Maryland Religious Toleration Act is that it extended that freedom of religion a little bit further. It extended it to any Christians. So you could be Catholic, you could be Anglican, you could be a Quaker or a Baptist. As long as you were a Christian, you were allowed to practice there freely. So it's an example of kind of starting a little bit this idea of freedom of religion. Now, it doesn't at this time extend to other religions, and if you denied the teachings of Jesus, you would actually be put to death, which is pretty extreme. But it's sort of the first little hint of freedom of religion, of people kind of not being told what they have to believe to belong to this colony. And then we also see blue laws, which are in some cases still a little bit in effect today, which banned certain things on Sundays. For example, in the New England colonies especially, where religion was a major part of life, they wanted Sunday to be reserved as a holy day, so it was a day where unnecessary work would not be done. It was a day where children were not allowed to play outside. It was a day where people did not listen to or play music or dance. It was kind of a strict religious day. Today, we still see in some states blue laws in effect with things like restrictions on alcohol sales on Sunday. And then one of the other things to talk about is how the British overall kind of approached the American colonies. And that involved something, a policy called salutary neglect. So if you neglect something, you sort of leave it alone, right? Salutary neglect was the British approach to governing the colonies. They left Americans alone as long as they were getting sort of their cut of the money, as long as they were profiting from their new colonies in the Americas. So they allowed Americans to sort of experiment with democracy, to make their own local rules and regulations, to kind of decide how trade was going to work there. And this is eventually going to change after the French and Indian War. Britain is going to fight this war against the French and the Native Americans in the colonies, and they're going to end up winning. So that part goes well for them. But like I tell my students, war is expensive. Think about all the costs. You need to pay for soldiers' salaries. You need to pay to ship soldiers over to fight. You need to have money to provide soldiers with guns, with ammunition, with food, with wagons, with other types of supplies, to build fortifications. All of that takes money. And sometimes countries need to borrow that money because you can't wait to kind of save up the money in the middle of a war. It needs to happen quickly. You can't be waiting around for years to get the funds to do this stuff. So you borrow the money. But the thing is, when I tell my students this, if you let a friend borrow some money from you, you expect that they're going to give it back. And it's the same for Britain. The money they borrowed, they're expected to pay back. So the way they can get that money to be able to pay back the their national debt, which was around 140 million British pounds, the way they can do that is by taxing people. And they plan to increase the taxes that they're going to put on their colonists. They're going to kind of put stricter regulations on who they can trade with. They're going to find ways to sort of extract money from the colonies to help pay off this debt. And that is going to kind of lead us into our next unit, where we're going to look at the American Revolution and kind of how that gets going.
Well, that's all for today. Thank you for joining us for covering the early European and English settlements in North America. For Nick and for Brendan, this is Kevin signing off and hoping that everyone stays safe during this COVID outbreak.